Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about reducing debt, that is. And to lead us in that discussion is Steve Lingle, certified financial planner, retired Fed, and fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Bob.
Good to have you here. And we're going to talk about reducing debt at various levels. And guest co-host John Elliott, retired Fed, retired seminar presenter, and federal benefit strategist. Is that accurately portrayed?
Good morning, Bob and Steve.
Okay.
Morning, John.
So let's have at it. You were kind enough to send an outline that even I can follow. And there are four kinds of debt that most people deal with regularly: house debt, car debt, credit card debt, college education debt. Take the first one first. I won't say everybody's got house debt, but probably many do. Today's shrinking interest rate environment, if we're talking about house debt, I guess the first issue would be, what is our interest rate on our principal mortgage? We'll talk about speeding up payments in a bit. But if somebody's either buying a house or refinancing a house, what do you advise them the best way to go with today's low rates? ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages, I shouldn't say ARMs, or fixed rate? And do they do 15 or do they do 30 years?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's pretty hard to get an ARM anymore. You can get one, but it's pretty hard. And I wouldn't really recommend those for most people. I think most people today, if they're getting a loan, if they're younger especially, should go for a 30-year loan. And the reason for that is that these very, very low interest rates that are available. You've got interest rates between, for 30 years, 3.5%, 3.75%. That's a very, very attractive rate, historically low rates. And I think there's a real benefit in having a rate like that, and frankly, maybe having it for 30 years. Now, if somebody is in the middle, maybe is refinancing, maybe they've only got 10 years left to retirement or 15 years, then I think a 15-year mortgage makes a lot of sense. I think they should look at that. So I think it just really depends on where someone is in the equation as to what they should look at.
Okay, so the beginning career individual, 30 years, finance as much as they can without having to do any points for those that aren't aware. It's a percentage of the loan that you would pay up front.
Right.
And I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, it's kind of like prepaying some of the interest or principal, call it what you want, and the lender says, listen, if you pay a point, two or three, seven is spread, three, we'll give you a lower rate. So you're really paying for something in advance. If it's an original purchase, it would be tax deductible. If it's a refi, it would be spread out as a deduction over the period of time. But when do you start to look at that and scratch your head and say, well, you know, maybe I'll put down a half or I'll put down a point because I'm at, again, historic lows, and what would you say, 3.75%, if I could get it down to 3.5% or 3.25%. One, does it make sense? That ignores the fact that when you first buy your home, you're scratching for every dollar you can, and points are about the last thing you want to pay for.
That's right. You know, the interesting thing is my son in Greenville, North Carolina, is looking to refinance. He doesn't have a lot to gain. His current loan is, I think, about 4.75%. But at 3.75%, he's gained a percent, and he can pay that all back in about 4 years, something like that. And he's got a really good deal there. But everybody that he has talked to so far down there wants an extra point to give him that low interest loan, and he doesn't want to pay it. And around here, you don't really have to pay that. With many lenders, the lender that my company uses doesn't usually charge those extra points to get these loans. So, you know, it's tough, but you ultimately have to do a little math here and figure out when you're going to repay your loan. And if you're going to repay it in fewer years than you're going to be in the house, that is, repay the cost of your closing cost and any points that you pay. If you're going to repay that in 4 or 5 years and you're sure you're going to be in the house that long, well, then that's a go situation.
Are there different areas of the country where mortgage rates are higher than, I mean, we're Metro D.C., but everybody listening isn't Metro D.C. Are there hot spots or cold spots where the lending is less less frequent, therefore the interest rates might be higher? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, actually, I don't really know either, but based on his experience, there's at least one area where the interest rates are a little bit higher because of that, and I suspect there may be others as well.
I would think maybe, and I'm guessing that Greenville, North Carolina is not a real populated area of North Carolina.
Well, they have University of North Carolina there, so not University of North Carolina, but the other university, the large one.
State.
North Carolina State, yes.
NC State.
Yeah.
NC State, yes.
Relatively whipped Maryland, yes.
Yeah, and it's a large university. I mean, they have over 30,000 students.
Okay, so Halstead, now let's mid-career. Somebody in a mid-career position probably isn't buying their first home, or they may be moving up, or they may be moving down. I don't know. Probably more so up than down, but they're kind of set. But if they're mid-career, they've had the house for a while, so probably the interest rate is greater on the mortgage than what they could get if they refinanced it. Now, if they refinanced it, some people are inclined to take, quote, money out. So they refinance the X dollars of debt, and then they borrow Y dollars more for whatever reason. They might want to make an improvement to the home. They might want to pay college debt. They just might want to have some more cash than what they have, and really the mortgage payment doesn't change much.
Right.
But from a tax perspective, they need to be careful with this. If they take cash out of it, they have something called original mortgage indebtedness. And let's say that you borrowed $200,000 for your home and now it's down to $150,000, so you refinance it. And you take out up to $250,000, you're fine with the deductibility. But if you go more than $100,000, you could lose it depending on what you do with the money. College education, that's a lot for college education, but the debt to the parent would be deductible, the debt to the child not,
right,
in that case. But if they go over the $100,000, then they need to be careful either to improve the home or invest the money, and then it's another type of interest. I'm probably putting people to sleep with that, but yeah, that's it. And then as you come closer, now, you know, personally, it was 3 or 4 years ago, the debt was paid down to a reasonable level, but we could refinance it with the lower rates and keep the payment where it was at the higher rate and pay it off. And we did a 5-year ARM, and it's gone in 5 years by keeping the payment up. It didn't really take any money out of our pocket, and it didn't take any money additional in the mortgage. So, I mean, from a financial perspective, I felt it was a good idea, and I don't know. Do you get clients that look at that and say, okay, what do I do here, Steve? And I'm sure your calculation would be much more sophisticated than mine. Mine was on a piece of paper.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's more sophisticated, but one of the things that we've told some purchasers to do is especially people who may be refinancing now. Maybe they just refinanced 3 or 4 years ago, and they've done that a couple of times over the last few years. And they say, gee, if we take out another 30-year loan, you know, we just keep taking out more 30-year loans all the time. And, you know, we're not getting anywhere. We're not paying off anything. And there is an argument that they could still do very well by taking out a 30-year loan if they simply make an extra mortgage payment on it once a year, for example. If they do that, they can pay the loan off in 21 years. And that's usually a very good thing for people to do. And the thing that I like about it is that you don't have to make that extra payment. If other things happen in your life, if you can't afford to make that one extra payment a year, then that's all you do. You just make the payment that you have to make for the 30-year loan. But if you can make it, it's a good way to pay down that loan in 21 years.
So just by making one extra payment, one monthly payment.
Wow, that's interesting.
One monthly payment a year.
Well, two.
Yeah, now let's go with two.
Well, then you could pay it down probably in 10 or 11 years. I mean, that is really
amazing.
Yeah,
John always quotes Albert Einstein's miracle of compound. I guess this works in reverse then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To our betterment. Not that the other one works to our detriment. They both work good, but in this case, it would be attractive. And you're right. You keep doing 30 years, and there you are at 65 with a 30-year note, and you go,
right.
Well, why did I do this to myself?
Right.
Potentially facing decreased revenue if a lot of people like to be debt-free later in their careers or certainly in retirement.
Or
sometimes easier said than done.
When they're about to send their kids to college as well.
Yes.
Would be a point where you'd like to be debt-free.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I always do remind people of, though, in terms of their desire to be debt-free, is that the money that you're going to use to become debt-free, whether you pay off your mortgage $50,000, $100,000, whatever it is toward the end, or whether you simply make extra payments, that money that you're using for that is money that would otherwise be in your investments. And so the simple test that I think everyone needs to make is they need to say, okay, I've got a 3.75% loan that I just got. If I pay that off early, that's 3.75%. Can I make more than that in an investment? Can I average over 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, whatever it is, more than that in an investment? And if they can, then they really shouldn't pay off that loan. Now, that's a tough argument for some people, because a lot of people, especially these days when we've had these terrible markets for a long time, just say, look, I just don't want to take that risk. I don't care if it's only a 4-point risk, 4% risk. I just don't want to take it. Well, that's fine. Then you pay your loan off early. But at today's interest rates, you really have to think about this a little bit.
Okay. Now, when you work with your clients, do you also look at their propensity to save and invest, or propensity to spend, or somewhere in between? So in other words, yeah, you got a less of a mortgage payment. They go, now I got more to spend. And of course, that's not why they're there to see you. You're going to tell them what you're going to do with their the additional cash flow.
That's right. Yes. And we do that, of course. We do that. And but what somebody may say today and what they may do with the money sometimes is different. And so,
how about the person that really they know better, but they can't sometimes help themselves? Is there a way to set up an investment vehicle that where the money just comes out of the account rather than them having to write the check, and then they can't spend it?
Well, actually, we have a client right now that we're dealing with on this, somebody who makes quite a lot of money, but basically spends it all. And we've decided that this person needs to save more, and we're trying to decide how we can get the person to save more. And the answer that we're thinking about is that maybe we need to try to convince this person to just allocate some amount of money, maybe it'll be $1,000 a month, to an account. Just automatically pay that out. And then, and the purpose of that is to reinvest it. And that way, they never have the money. They don't see it. They don't have it to spend. And so that's one thing that we're doing right now to try to get someone to do that.
All right. We don't want to certainly talk about this person by name or even gender. Is this person mid-career, pre-retirement, beginning? Where are they?
This person is about probably 6 or 7 years from retirement.
Not good to be a spender at that stage
of
the game.
Isn't.
No,
you've got
to be an accumulator. All right, but again, it's easier said
than
done.
And we've run a retirement projection, and it's a little iffy. So that's why we want this person to try to save more money.
All righty. We're 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. We're speaking with Steve Lingle, certified financial planner, retired Fed seminar presenter. We're talking about reducing debt with John Elliott, guest co-host. And he has all the above. I guess the only thing you're not, it's a financial planner, right?
I am not a financial planner.
But
except for my own finances.
Except for your own finances.
Although I do have a financial planner.
Okay.
Always a good investment to have both a tax accountant and a financial planner.
Certainly the former. Okay, so TALS debt, I think we covered it. Car debt. I mean, everybody just can't sit down, even if they have a decent trade-in, they go into debt for a car. We talked about the four different types of debt. This would be the second, car debt. Some people say, if I can't pay for this with my old car in cash, I'm not going to buy the car. And so
it was my grandparents' attitude. Yeah. They never took on car debt.
But in today's world, I hate to sound like a geezer, but it seems like there's an appeal to buy, not the high-end cars, but the medium high-end cars, and we're going to finance some of the debt. But how you finance it, if you finance it through the dealer, there's one thing certain, you're probably going to get a low rate, and there's another thing certain, you're not going to get a tax deduction. Now, one should never do anything just to get a tax deduction, but if they were to use an equity line on the house, people are squeamish about that. Depending on the interest rate, it might make more sense to do that, and it would then make what otherwise would be a non-deductible car loan a deductible. I think the car companies are aware of this, so they offer attractive financing that might even be better than an equity line after tax. So somebody's got to push them paper to pencil. I think it's the other way to buy a car is no debt. We're going to lease a car.
Right.
I don't know about that one. When you lease a car, it looks pretty attractive, but how do they determine what a lease rate is? I mean, it's really somebody's got to lend the money to somebody to pay for the car.
Right.
And then they have to cover their overhead, I'd imagine, to be able to buy the car and not the service on the car, but the service of the lease. Do you have any rule of thumb there for if somebody is going to lease one, that they lease it initially and buy it after the lease term is over, or do they just keep leasing and it's like a never-ending monthly payment?
Well, I'll have to tell you, I've never leased a car. That'll give you some idea of my position on this, because I think it costs more to lease a car. And I think the general statistics are that if you're only going to own a car for a short period of time, for whatever reason, probably 3 to 4 years, then it's okay to lease it. Because if you buy a new car, that's when you get your biggest depreciation and you can't really sell it and get enough out of it. So In that case, I would say, okay, go ahead and lease a car. But if you're going to own a car for four more years, I'd say always buy a car, because you're going to get a better deal, a lower cost than you will if you rent it. There are so many different provisions that car manufacturers have on leases. You know, the maximum number of miles that you can drive, for example, and you have to pay if you drive more miles than that. And so I think the thing to do is to buy. Now, the other thing, though, is when you buy, you don't have to buy a new car. And that's pretty important, because these days there are plenty of 1 and 2 year old cars out there that have already taken that first year or 2 years of depreciation on the car. And they make very, very good purchases right now. So I would say, if you need a new car and you're trying to save money, just buy a used car and finance it in some way. But there's another angle on that as well.
My last new car was 1976. I always buy them through. I buy them off a lease. A lot of people lease cars, and you get a pretty good deal.
Yes, you can, off of a lease car.
And if you can get one that's still covered under some type of warranty, or you get some add-on, whatever they call it, certified or whatever, and I've had very good luck. Maybe I didn't have the newest car, but that's okay. If I kept it 3 to 5 years beyond that, the cost per month was pretty low.
And you know, the other thing is, you mentioned that people probably will finance their car in some way, but one of the things that that we recommend to all of our clients is set up a kind of a prepayment plan for a car, where you buy a car this year, and then you're putting down money in your own account. You're not paying any interest on it, and after a certain number of years, maybe it's 8 or 10, whatever it is, you've got enough money to buy a new car, and then you buy a new car with your own money, or you buy a used car with your own money.
And also buying cars, and we're talking about the listeners buying the car, but sometimes the listeners have to buy a car for them, and if they have the cash flow to do it, sometimes somebody of college age might need a car. Other people listening say they don't need a car; they're going to college. You know, they should be happy that they're going to college. So that could be an issue. Now, we're probably not buying new cars for them, and we're probably not leasing a car, but we're buying safe used cars, I guess.
Yeah,
John. I mean, maybe I shouldn't ask you this, but what do you do with your kids?
Well, I have two, and we had four cars at one point in the family, so there's your answer. And when they went to college, they had those cars at college. Now, did they need the, they went away to school. I mean, 100 miles south of us in Virginia, in Charlottesville. Now, did they need cars? No, they lived near campus, so, and they walked to classes. But on the other hand, to come home, a car was useful. I'm not sure how you get home from Charlottesville without a car, but probably is a bus or something. But yeah, we had four cars, and they weren't new cars for them. They were cars that we had that we passed on to them, and then we bought new cars for ourselves.
Wise decision. Then the other way around.
Well, sure. Yeah. Then one broke down, and we had to buy a new car for my daughter, because her previous car just wouldn't go anymore.
Okay.
So, but currently my son, they both graduated, my son who's working in downtown DC can walk to work. So he doesn't really need a car. So,
I was reading a stat on that not long ago about, the resurgence of the urban areas and the folks moving into the urban areas didn't necessarily need a car. A Zipcar was fine.
Yeah, right.
Or a bike.
Well, a lot of Zipcars are being used now.
I saw one last night in D.C. And I just became aware of them, and I think my son's aware of them. He hasn't needed to use one because, again, he can walk to his job.
Which even see Zip
a wonderful
bikes
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, those are big in Paris, I learned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just came back from a little trip to Paris, and there are a lot of these. They're really nice, like new bikes parked in lots all over the city, and people go pick one up, get on it, and go somewhere in it. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. Alrighty, credit card debt. I mean, if we have it, how do we extinguish it? If we have to live with it, how do you break somebody's credit card habit? Let's just talk about that first, and then second, in order for them to break the habit, they got to pay off the old. How do they do that? Because that interest rate is not low.
No,
maybe other interest rates have dropped. But that hasn't dropped.
It's sickeningly high. Yeah. It's brutal.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when we have clients that have high credit card debt, we point out the fact that the rates are so high, and we just tell them, you know, this is not going to work if you want to save any money, and you have to start bringing this down. And, you know, there are some people out there who just can't resist buying certain things using credit cards. And if you're one of those people, you've got a real problem, and you might even want to go get some personal counseling for that. But otherwise, we point it out to people. We try to get them on a plan where they pay off. There are a couple of ways to do it. You can find the card with the highest debt and try to get rid of that, and or you can simply find the card with the least debt and try to pay that off. Or you can move the debt to a new card that might have a smaller debt. There's the whole credit card issue is it has a lot of different twists and turns to it. But one way or another, people have to stop overcharging on their credit cards.
Yeah, I'm not a financial planner, but I have clients that have too much debt. And I go, would you like a risk-free investment that returns 5% and could be as much as 18%? And they're like, oh, there's not an investment like that. And I go, yeah, there is. Pay your credit card down. And for every dollar of principal that you pay down, you're saving anywhere from 5% to 18% in interest.
That's right.
And they go, oh, never looked at it that way.
That's right.
And it's really wasted interest as well, because there's no tax benefit to it, generally speaking.
Well, when you're paying by credit card and not paying it off every month, the amount you're paying for those goods or services you bought, if you really calculated the cost above and beyond the purchase price in the store, it should scare you
into
paying down your debt and then trying at all costs to just pay it off on a monthly basis. I mean, we haven't had credit card debt in I don't know how many years.
Right.
Just pay it off every month. I realize a lot of people aren't
able to do it,
but we're fortunate enough to be able to do it. So I don't know why the credit card companies keep us on their rolls. I guess, you know, maybe is the annual fee we pay them worth it? I don't know. But I treat it as a convenience, you know.
Yeah, I agreed.
Right.
All righty. College education debt. Now, we probably spend a good few minutes here, but it seems to me that there's an awful lot, I won't say of choices of where to get the money, but how you finance it. There are a number of different ways. And then whose debt is it? Somebody with kids in college or probably mid-career, late mid-career, pre-retirement, So their incomes might be such that they don't get any tax deduction for the interest paid, where the child, if you will, that's being educated would, but then they're saddled with the debt. So how do you shop for that? Truth of the matter is, people bring in their, what do they call that, FAFSA form?
FAFSA, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, can you help me fill this out? I thought a right. tax return was hard.
And
there isn't much that you don't divulge in that thing.
Yeah.
And then it's, you got to be careful with who owns assets and the like. If the parent owns the asset, sometimes they're not going to get it. If the child owns the asset, maybe they're not going to get the loan. But how do you shop for college education debt?
Well, I think the first thing, of course, you do is every student, every single student has to fill out the FAFSA and has to apply for this. I mean, it's just part of the routine of entering a college. And often there's also one for private schools that they may have to fill out, too, if they're going to a private school. And if you are not financially well off, your child, or if you have several children going to college at the same time, you might qualify for some college aid. And that's the first place that these loans come in. They're Stafford loans, that's what they're called, Stafford loans, and they're college aid loans. Now, these are the loans that you probably have heard about recently, that the interest rate is going to double by the end of this month. July 1st, the interest rate doubles unless the federal government does something.
And what is it now? It's like
3.4%,
and it's going to go up to 6.8%.
That's right. And as you know, there's another big hoorah in Congress about, you know, the Republicans say they want to pay it off, but they want to take the money from this location. The Democrats say they want to pay it off, but they want to take the money from another location. They can't agree on the location. So,
well, one proposal, this would be of interest to our federal listeners, is employees, that is, not retirees, is that they're going to raise the amount the feds have to contribute to their respective retirement plans, both CERS and FERS, and they want to use that money to, I guess, finance these Stafford loans. Or is it something else? Or am I getting confused?
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, I think it's been in the papers. But so anyway,
I thought they were going to raise the contribution rate. This was a while ago, just to put more money in the annuity coffers.
Well, this is just a proposal.
Okay.
Yeah, a reason.
Another
justification to raise the contribution rates.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, for however they use it. The retirement funds are not in particular jeopardy.
Right.
And the taxpayers aren't really on the hook like they are in some states and localities,
right,
with
mm-hmm.
these large state and local pension funds. The two federal funds are fine. So if you're out there and a federal employee, and you can breathe a sigh of relief. A lot of this is political.
Okay.
Politically driven as opposed to financially driven.
Okay. And we covered both sides of the aisle. Okay, this is good. All righty, so college debt, what's a good, if somebody wasn't fortunate enough to be able to come see somebody like you, are there books on this? Do they Google it? Bestcollegerates.com? Is there something? There's probably a site for that. But
there are all kinds of websites that you can go to look for college loans. FineAid.com and lots of others where you can look for college loans. I think the one thing that people need to watch out for is that sometimes kids, when they go to school, just aren't thinking about a loan. They've got a lot of things on their mind. They're just not thinking about a loan, and they just go ahead and get the money, and pretty soon it adds up to a very substantial amount. But if they get to the point where the amount that they're over debt when the loan debt exceeds the annual income. In other words, if they have more loan debt than they're going to have annual income in their job, and this does happen, it does happen, it happens all the time, then they're in a fundamentally unstable situation. So that's one thing that they should really watch out for. I'm sure you've both heard that most of the people in college now seem to have loans. And in fact, the loan debt exceeded credit card debt for the first time this year. And it's about $1 trillion.
Yeah, it's staggering.
Yeah.
And some people talked about it, that as the next financial bubble.
Right.
But before we forget, another great way, I think, to finance college education is through 529s.
Absolutely. That's the way that we recommend every client that we have who has kids going to college, we recommend that they set up a 529 plan so that they can afford it.
At birth.
Well, yeah, as soon as they can, yeah. At birth. Yes, absolutely. The problem is that a lot of people just think, at least, that they can't afford it. They can't put very much money in there, and they keep thinking this, and time goes on, college costs keep going up, and they get to college, and they just don't have enough money for their kids.
Okay, now a 529, just so that I can remember it, is is an investment provision that somebody can fund. It doesn't have to be the parents. It could be grandparents. It could be friends. It could be whomever. And this money goes into this investment, and it's invested wherever, stock market,
well, it's invested
bonds,
in one of the states.
Yeah.
But that's the
but
type
it's invested.
Of investment. Yes.
Yeah. And different states have different investment houses that manage that state's fund. But the idea there is it would grow over the years, and then it wouldn't be taxed if it was used for those educational purposes
right.
when the child went. And I don't know that everybody can afford to fully fund 4 years of college with these, but certainly
right.
whatever they can do, it's good.
Well,
it's
yeah.
kind of like insurance.
It's anyway. Less than you have to borrow.
That's right.
Now, they have different types, if I'm not mistaken. They have prepaid tuition, and they where you actually spend X dollars and you kind of lock in the rates.
Yeah. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, but I at least in Virginia, they used to have a prepaid plan, and that's not what we did with our two kids, but they have gone to, I guess, like most states, the 529. There may be some states where you can still prepay it.
Yeah, there are 11 states.
11? Well, you
yeah,
know.
There are 11 states where you can still get a prepaid tuition.
Okay, and do you have any opinion, if you have that option, prepay or a 529, do you have any, I'm sure you do, an opinion as to which would be the best way to go?
Well, I think the prepaid plan is a good plan if your child is going to go to college in the state that you live in.
Right.
Because they will get the maximum tuition that is paid anywhere in that state, and they will get all of that paid. Now, if they go out of state to a different college, they will still get a benefit, but the benefit is a little less. And so I think that what we usually tell people is, if you're sure your child will go to school in this state, then go with the prepaid plan, because there's really no risk there. You know, if you can get... A lot of the plans are based on a payment of about 8%. Boy, these days, if you can get 8%, no risk, that's, guaranteed, that's great.
That's what I was going to say. As the child gets closer to the finish line of high school, the prepaid tuition, if it's available in their state, becomes, I think, more attractive than the 529, because they lock in at a pretty
right.
nice inflation-protected investment that you can't lose. Of course, they could change their mind 3 days before they go to college and go out of state. But on the short run, they look a little bit better than the long run. The long run, if you buy them at birth or 5 years old, who knows where they're going to go.
Right.
But let's take a look at that one then. If it's a 529 plan, then wherever they live, even though they might have it in that state, it's portable to be paid to a school out of state.
That's right.
So in the state that you live in, if it has a tax benefit on top of it, some are better than others.
Tax benefit from contributing to the state and getting a deduction for contributions, right. Yes.
But they're not locked into that state.
Right.
Unless it's prepaid tuition.
No, that's right.
Okay. All right. That's just a little a twist, especially, you know, if they're grandparents. Sometimes the parents can't afford, you know, a young child have enough trouble paying the bills now. But grandparents are very good friends. Aunt and uncles might want to do something. Rather than a bunch of new outfits. Oh, I shouldn't say that, but sound too much. It's too much like an accountant. All right.
By the way, one of the things that we always tell people is, when you're looking for a school, you've got to be really particular these days. You can't just ask your kid where they want to go to school. You know, where do you want to go? Well, I want to go here or there because that's where my friends are going or whatever. You've got to talk to them about the fact, look, this is real money. And we may, you know, there's only so much we can afford. And then based on that, they may go to a school within your state, which is always cheaper. They may go to a public school in another state. And the last option is they may go to a private school. But private schools are so expensive that to go there, they have to have good enough grades that they can get some significant college aid. So that's another factor.
Yeah, when I graduated from college, there wasn't, where am I going to go? It's, you are going to go there. It was in-state school.
Yeah.
But nowadays, getting into state schools is becoming more and more competitive because of the lower tuition rates, particularly if you live in a state with a high reputation state school, you know. Mm-hmm. So they can be highly competitive and hard to get into. You do need good grades, good SATs.
They can. Yes.
But if you can do it, and particularly if they can, if your state school has a good academic reputation, not a sports reputation, just an academic reputation, it is a real, real good deal as opposed to going private.
Yeah, it is.
Because there are a lot of good liberal arts private, small liberal arts private schools, but I imagine they cost quite a bit.
Yes, they do.
These days.
Yes, they do.
All right, we kind of sliced and diced here. Now let's, there's a question that's here. It says, if I'm underwater in my home, should I walk away from it?
Mm.
Now, we can't provide general guidance on this, so let's try to take both sides of it. If I just walk away from it, is my credit going to be hurt?
Sure.
But of course. All right. If I just walk away from it, currently from a tax position, it would be waived, but I think that's potentially on the chopping block, but that won't be available much longer. It's potentially. Now, I didn't say it's gone, so no one should run off to do whatever they're going to do by the end of the calendar year. I don't know. But I think the hit that the person is going to take on the credit might be more painful than staying in it unless they just really bought it the upper end for their dream house, and now it's at the lower end, and there's just no way they're going to get out from underneath it.
Right.
Should a car become a debt, or should I pay it off? I mean, let's just say I bought a car over the years. I'm buying the car, not to beat this car thing to death, but as I progress through my career, I might have some more cash flow to pay the debt off rather than buy the more expensive car.
Yeah, I think a car should, especially after you've had a chance, you know, you've been going for just a few years, you should be able to save enough money to buy a car. You should not have to finance a car anymore. Now, most people don't do that. And when they don't do that, it means that they're going to pay whatever the interest rate is. Right now, they're very low. for a car. But if they have to pay a little bit more, maybe 5-6% in some cases, 7%, then that really starts to bite. And they can avoid that. All you have to do is just save some money. That's all you have to do, save money for a car.
Save money for a car, or do shopping for the loan. I look at the ads in the paper, and there are two really big credit unions in town on the military side, and I just marvel at how low the rates are.
Yeah.
And then you look at what they pay for CDs, and you say, how do they make any money? I know they make money on the spread, and they don't pay much in taxes, income taxes, the credit unions. But, wow.
Yeah.
And I'm sure just, you know, I go Google everything. I research via Google. low car interest rates.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And that pops this. And same thing if somebody's shopping for certificates of deposit, it's very hard to get any great ones with any kind of federal guarantee. But
right.
Nonetheless, you can find it on the net. Not the be-all, end-all, but it's a good place to start.
Yeah, it is. It is. By the way, Bob, I wanted to just mention that for people who are underwater on a mortgage and they don't want to just walk away, there are some good federal programs. I say good federal programs. I know people have had some problems getting what they wanted out of these programs. But back in April, the president signed the foreclosure settlement program with, I think it was five different banks, which was designed to basically reduce the principal and let you refinance at today's rates if you were underwater, as long as you're a person who's been making the payments. You're not making the payments. It just got caught in this downdraft. And so that's one program that people should look at. And there's another one that's somewhat similar to it that's only for people whose loans are owned by Fannie or Freddie, and those are the Federal Home Affordable Refinance Program. It's called the HARP program. And that's a good program, too, because you can have a home value that is no more than 125% of your loan and still qualify for that program. Then if you've got some more problems and you're basically going to have some difficulty with any kind of a payment, you can go to the HARP program, HARP, H-A-R-P, Federal Home Affordable Refinance Program. You do have to have made 12 or more continuous payments on the loan. And again, Fannie or Freddie owns it. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I said that wrong. I said the HARP program again. It's the HAMP program, Home Affordable Mortgage Program. And the current mortgage payment, if it's more than 31% of your gross income, then you can go to that one. So the point is, if you're underwater, start. It's a lot of work, but start exploring these federal programs.
If we go now, you mentioned Fannie. That's not Aunt Fannie, and it's not Uncle Freddie.
No, it's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Okay, they're quasi government agencies.
Yes,
correct.
Yes.
All right, and they would have these programs. But if we did participate in one of these programs, would our credit take a nick?
Well, it might, but it might not, too. I mean, it might take a little bit of a nick, but it shouldn't, especially the HARP program or the foreclosure settlement program. Those shouldn't be too bad on your credit rating.
Okay, so when our listeners are shopping, they would want to look for the best rate,
that's
but
right.
They would also want to make sure that, it, you know, unless they have to, that the credit is not going to take a ding.
That's right.
As opposed to walking away from it when it's underwater.
That's right. And then there's another option, which is called a short sale. Now, you know about those because you see them advertised all the time. Now, that may be an option too, but you have to be careful. You have to negotiate with the lender, make sure they're going to forgive the loan, because otherwise they can come back and say that you still have to pay at some later time the amount that they didn't get that you still owed on the house. So a short sale can be a little tricky, but it works at times. It works at times, and there are a lot of them.
All right. We're coming towards the end here. You got a bullet point here and it says, shop for what you can afford.
Yeah,
that's really hard to get to people. But if somebody is, as we talked about, we've all worked with people that can afford to be better off than what they are. They're okay, but they just spend up to their income. How do you break through that psychology? And if we don't have that much time, we have about a minute. But how do you work with them? Do you show them graphs of the growing cost of the borrowing and say, if you continue this way, you're not going to be able to do this. Wouldn't you rather be over on this other chart enjoying more money saved or enjoying a potential better retirement?
Well, that's what we do. That's what we do. I don't know if other people have found better ways, but we run a retirement projection, and then we can show them where, you know, you're just spending too much here, or your debt is just leaning too heavily on this projection.
All right,
and we try to show them the data.
I'm getting the high sign, so give me your website quickly, or phone number, either one. Andrew's going to cut us off in another 10 seconds.
Okay, it's slingle@lighthouse.com. Lighthouse FP. F, that's F as in Frank, P.com.
And Lingle is
Lingle. Right.
And we have to go. Thanks having you, Steve. John, good to see you again. Andrew, thanks for keeping us straight. And we'll be on next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.